Tervetuloa. Welcome. Bienvenue. I'm Ida Simes, Voima magazine, and here is Kianos Ramezani. Please do introduce yourself, Kianos, in the way you want. But you're from Iran, I have to say that in the beginning.
Yeah, my name is Kianos, and I'm an Iranian political cartoonist in exile since 2009. I got asylum protection from France, and I'm sharing my time between Helsinki and Paris since a couple of years. And I work with French journals and media as a cartoonist.
Yes. And you draw very political cartoons, and you have very, very strong points in your cartoons. We will talk more carefully about them, but just say something about that. You are very critical towards the regime of Iran, the regime that now seems to be partly destroyed.
Well, yes, and since I had to flee my country, the issue became quite also personal for me, because I was affected myself by the regime as a forced exile, another forced exile artist. So, and then coming to France as a refugee, I realized that how it's important to point at the crimes and the nature of such a regime, because it would be a good exposure for European and, let's say, for the democratic countries. So I kept doing that, what I used to do as a political cartoonist back in Iran, with a huge limit, of course, and a lot of red lines. But then back in France, I slowly kind of got used to my freedom, which was a new life for me, as really from the scratch. Then my work became more and more and more, let's say, frank, and more, let's say, kind of with more political kind of brutality, and until present.
I know, I have seen your cartoons, and you are really, really frank person. Just say some of the magazines to which you draw, and also you are a friend of many journalists and cartoonists of Charlie Hebdo. This is the magazine when many of its cartoonists were killed in 2015 in the Islamic massacre, which was like pro-Islamic. Oh, well, how would you say about that?
It was very a good chance of me
to end up... It was a terrorist attack.
It was a terrorist attack. Yeah. No, but back in the previous part of your question, well, I mean, I was one of the lucky ones who happened to find exile in France, which is the country of the political cartoon. So I can tell you that the first year was very, very difficult for me, as many refugees who were finding themselves in a very totally different world, different language, different culture. But at the same time, I was received with huge solidarity by colleagues, by French cartoonists, and then Reporters Without Borders. Slowly, I could actually find my way and to be continuing what I used to do as a political cartoon. And I think I see it as a very, very big luck. So the first magazine that actually interviewed me and gave me visibility professionally was actually Charlie Hebdo. Back in 2010, when I was a homeless refugee, so they found me and then they kind of interviewed me. I had a double page actually interview with Charlie Hebdo in 2010. So it's very historical for me, the whole story of Charlie Hebdo. But then back then I started working as a freelancer with Courrier International, which is a very free way of working as a freelancer cartoonist. And then it continued, you know, a lot of exhibitions, a lot of, even pedagogical projects I've done. I actually found myself really a home, I can call it professional home too, for me as a political cartoonist. And luckily it continued despite me moving again to, I mean, from France to Finland, still it didn't cut my connections to France. And yes, I found myself a lot of friends, colleagues, including the assassinated cartoonist of Charlie Hebdo. And yeah, I'm very involved in what is happening in France also. And it became my very sensitive topic since then.
Hmm. Well, yeah, that is a mecca of cartoons, if you can say that.
Yes.
That is a very funny way to put it. But anyway, let's talk about current affairs that have happened. And we have to refer to politics, but I would like to hear about your opinion on culture in Iran, what you know that has been going on in Iran. You have not been there recently, but I mean, you are still following things. You have friends there, you have family there, you have contacts, and you can follow what is going on in the news. I just have to mention that now we are doing this interview in the beginning of March 2026, and the United States have just attacked Iran. They have hit Tehran and other cities and possibly places where they have missiles or military by airstrikes, not just the USA, but also Israel, it seems. Before this, they started these airstrikes in Iran in February 2026, besides that there were some airstrikes before that. But also the United States have stricken to Venezuela in January 2026, and then they have blown up 45 vessels, meaning ships and fast speedboats in the sea, in Latin America and Caribbean Sea. About 151 people have died in these attacks. And then in December 2025, the USA attacked Nigeria. Well, there is no information on how many casualties there have been. And in Somalia, they hit 111 times in 2025. And in Yemen, there have been about 80 casualties in very military airstrikes in March, between March and May 2026, and then in December 2025 to Syria. And also they took out one military general in Iraq in March 2026. So if I count here, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, plus also the vessels, so it's 8 different kind of military strikes that have been conducted by the USA, plus that they have also caused a lot of semi-military turmoil in their own country. So this is a very warmongering regime they have in the United States, and very, very warmongering president they have in the United States. So, but please, Kianush, tell something what you have now recently heard about Iran. Well, nobody is saying that Ali Khamenei's death is some kind of a, I mean, well, I don't, that's not according to any kind of law to take man out like that. But anyway, I don't think there are sort of ordinary people mourning about his death, but
yes, okay. Yeah, I have my own take.
In the street.
Yes,
yeah,
I have my own
do.
Observation.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, also because now I'm not living anymore mm-hmm. in Iran, unfortunately. But also, as you mentioned, yeah, I'm in constant contact with my family and friends and trustees.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, back in January, just recent January, the Iranian regime, under the direct authority of Khamenei, the supreme leader of Iran. I'm very happy to say that the former supreme leader of Iran is not living anymore. So he assassinated, he killed, mass murdered Iranians in the streets. It was a huge casualty, historical casualty. I mean, there are some historians, they are actually comparing it to the casualties of the First World War. In 2 days, more than 30,000 civilians confirmed killed.
That's awful.
It's
That's
awful.
So and it, much.
And
yeah.
Even in Iran, it has been very exceptional. So it happened, and of course, you know, the whole population got shocked, and then they got even more full of, you know, revenge and, you know, rage and, you know, mourning, etc., etc. But then, looking at the whole state of the world, as you mentioned, you know, Donald Trump, and the very, very uselessness of the actual United Nations, I have to point out, for example, you know, after this massacre, the United Nations appointed Iran as one of its own kind of the leaders of the Human Rights Council. You know, this turned to be a pure joke for Iranians. But I hope also for the other people of the other nations that you're actually watching. I also believe that probably United Nations lost its sense, and probably there should be a very serious reform about what is a United Nation anymore. And then meanwhile we have this new kind of born or new organized jungle that is who is the strongest, who have the more weapons, then they're going to kind of impose their power in the world, including Donald Trump from one side, let's say free world, and then we have Putin from the other side. Mm-hmm. And then we have the kind of more silent one, this guy Xi from China. So we in the 21st century, when I say we, I mean I can actually talk on my own behalf. As a political cartoonist, the one who constantly observes the world political and also human rights, I feel so desperate, you know. I mean, I really, it's very hard for me to remain optimistic, to actually have faith in the democratic, you know, values and, you know, the international law. And I see them kind of being violated in daily basis. What happened in Iran, it's a violation of the, you know, another sovereign country like Iran. You know, they just attack Iran. I mean, U.S. and Israel together. They worked on it for many months. They finally managed. And I can tell you, it has been a huge, complicated kind of work of espionage before done by Mossad, because they have so much influence inside Iran. So they know exactly what's happening. And then they feed the information and details to the U.S., and then they strike. So that's how we are not surprised that actually Khamenei has been killed that easily in a most humiliating way. I mean, the reason why people are actually celebrating in the middle of this chaos is that because they really wanted him to be done, to be gone, and because he's responsible for mourning of thousands of families and generations. So this is very strange, you know. At one side, Iranians are celebrating, but at the same time, they can see their kind of neighborhood, their house is being bombed and targeted by drones and missiles and, you know, high weapons. And the whole Middle East is now is droning, let's say, the safe haven that they were kind of selling for rich people for decades. Let's talk about Dubai. Let's talk about the United Arab Emirates. You know, it's not a safe place anymore. We could see how the drones, the Iranian Shahed drones, actually they are hitting the very fancy residential kind of towers. So I'm watching all of this. And at the same time, I try to be focused. I try to be all the time kind of listening to what's happening. Luckily, I have friends who are still have connection with the Starlink. Mm-hmm. So they can we can exchange some, because the whole communication is
They are using Starlink.
Yes. In Iran, some people are using a Starlink, even though it's huge risk. But for example, one of my friends who is a journalist, previously had been imprisoned, we are very close friend. He risked his life because his project is to document all crimes against humanity done by the regime. So it's his dedication for life, and he's going to do that no matter what the price is. So I have been smuggling his reports to French journals and newspapers under the false name, of course. And he is one of my very trusted, you know, sources. So thanks to him, I can understand what's going on really on the ground.
Wow, after we are done with this interview on in audio format, show me some of those that have been published, and I want to quote them in my article too. I don't even know the name of your friend, so I can't slip it out in any kind of accident. Okay, but hey, let's talk about Dubai and Qatar soon, but first still about Iran. Because you are a specialist also on how people have reacted to its theocratic dictatorship over the years, and this 30,000 dead people after the demonstrations, that's an awful, awful tragedy. But I read somewhere at that time when people were demonstrating out in the streets, like a month ago or so, that actually the people in Iran are not really religious, which is sort of intriguing to think about, because the governing regime and total dictatorship, total tyranny, is saying that they are so theocratic. But actually, is that just a shallow theocracy, just masking something like big money somewhere elsewhere? That
You know, the nature of the Iranian regime is kind of officially Islamic state.
Of course, officially
Islamic state based on Sharia, which is the Islamic constitution, and it's a very old one. So even the justice system in Iran is based on Sharia. So that's why we have harsh kind of punishments and, you know, execution, death penalty, etc., etc. Because it's been based on very, very old time. Mm-hmm. And they never changed it anyway. But Iranian people, well, of course they're not. They're not even... I cannot call them atheist. Even though the new generation of Iranian are mostly atheist, I can call these actual youngsters, they don't believe in any religion. But then we have a very considerable...
Who don't believe? A majority or majority of the young people?
Majority
or young people
of the youngsters, I mean, which is the new generation in Iran. And they are not a few number. They are huge. I mean, the population of Iran
tens
is young.
Tens of millions.
Yes, at least I would say half of the population of Iran, they're very young. I mean, now we are 92 million.
Yeah.
So you can imagine
it's
army
like 50
of
million.
Almost less than 50 million of Iranians. They are young and they don't believe in anything. So it's very important to consider that. But then we have another part of the majority who are spiritual. I mean, as Iranian, we have been always spiritual. So we believe in there is something, there is some guide somewhere. But we don't practice, which means that they don't say prayer, they don't follow everyone. And then the last part are the people whose life is 100% dependent to the Iranian regime. They work for the regime. And they are not a small number either, let's say. Up to 10 million. Up to 10 million people, they are actually working for the regime. In the institutions, in the constitution, you know, in the army, I mean, semi-army. I mean, luckily or bad luck in Iran, we have three types of armies. We have the official army, and then we have the guardian of the revolution, and then we have the Basij. So it's huge. It's a huge number of people who are actually directly involved in military activities and actions. So those guys, they're still there. But then by consequences, we can see that they are getting blown off and they're getting killed. I mean, when people see that, it's a very positive side of this chaos. So by contrast, they are celebrating while they are listening to the you know, these huge explosions. And we see them dancing in the street because of that, because they can see that their enemy is being killed by consequences. And
you mean that the followers of the harsh regime are being
the
killed?
Members, the members of the revolution, the guards, the members of this militia, they are being killed, and because they know their targets anyway. So, but then I need to mention that Iranians as nation, they are so attached to the Iran as a concept. You know, I think Finnish people understand that very well, because, you know, they love Iran. They're not nationalists. They just love the land that they belong to. It's a very beautiful love kind of connection between themselves and the motherland. They call it motherland. You know, it's not coming from nowhere, you know. So Iran is a very sensitive value for them. So when it comes to that, we hardly accept any external military operation. We never accepted occupation. Mm-hmm. And it's in our history. It's in our DNA, I would say. So this is actually an oxymoron that it's actually very difficult to explain when I try to explain it mm-hmm. to my audience here.
But, yeah. So, well, they are celebrating because they wanted to get rid of this tyranny, and no matter whether they felt partially also Muslim or maybe they believe in something else, but definitely this hard kind of, or harsh, like you said, harsh kind of Sharia Islam is not their choice of religion anyway. So actually majority of people do not respect this tyranny. And one thing I have to ask you, because it has so much to do with the neighboring countries too, is also this between Shia and Sunni Muslims. Is that causing tensions in the area? Is that the sort of thing that could have its consequences?
No, it's an old observation, and it needs to be upgraded. You know, I heard it when I moved to Europe. This conflict between Shia and Sunni would make sense if we were still in 60s and 70s, but it's not the case anymore.
That was like the origin of the conflict when Shah was still there.
Yes, it was. Okay. Yes, it was. But it's not now. It's purely about power. Mm-hmm. Who is more powerful in the region? That's actually it's just the question now. Even when it comes to, you know, this competition between Saudi Arabia, Qatar and the others, it doesn't go through their belief or their interpretation of Islam. It's just about power. Who is going to say the last word? But then I can hear a lot of theories that, yeah, this guy is from Wahhabi and the other one is Sunni, the other one is, you know, whatever, Salafi. Yes and no. I mean, I don't believe that, you know, this kind of bold political moves comes from that. I think it's just when it comes to society, it might make sense for, you know, it kind of categorize people in their different societies. Yes, I mean, Iran also, we have a very, very minority of Sunni people. They are practicing their thing and they are suffering from the regime, of course, because the Islamic State of Iran only recognizes officially, the official religion of Iran is Shiism. And mm-hmm. then they recognize the Sunnis in a very, very oppressive way. They also recognize the other minorities even worse, kind of oppressing way, like Christianity, like, you know even Jewish. There is a very, very micro Jewish minority in Iran, those who still live there and they didn't escape to Israel. They have their own representative in the parliament, so-called parliament. But that's, we see them as a poster boy. I mean, they have no equal power. They have no equal influence in the politics whatsoever.
That reminds me a bit of the situation between Russia and Ukraine, when people are actually afterwards, after the conflict has begun, they are starting to use religion as some kind of a power play thing, even though it has not been that originally. Also, like language is that kind of power play that when the conflict already is there, then they start saying that, yeah, but this has so much to do with the religion. These Ukrainians, they didn't want to support the patriarch of Moscow, and many Ukrainians say that, hey, we don't care actually who is the patriarch, but actually, yeah, we do not respect your patriarch because he's a friend of Putin's and he has his own airplane jet. Yeah, he does have a jet. So anyway, so yeah, we have our own patriarch. But you know, when people go to the church in Ukraine or in Russia, they actually do not care. They don't care.
Exactly.
But politically, you can put the sort of stamp on them that, these don't support the patriarch there and sort of thing. So do you feel that this Shia-Sunni thing could be used like that, that the it
No, because there is no, actually, there is no alternative. For example, I remember when the way we grew up, you know, whoever is the supreme leader of Iran, they consider themselves as the leader of the world of Shi'i Islam. Mm-hmm. It's just the title they give to themselves. And then at the same time, we have another dude, to another Ayatollah in Iraq. They call themselves the leader of the world of Shi'ism. And those poor guys in Iraq, they actually, they have a point, because the actual Imam of Shi'ism, Ali, he is buried there. So he is from Kufa. He is from Iraq. So, and all these Ayatollahs of Iran, they are studied, they're religious, that they became the great of the Ayatollah in Najaf, in Iraq. So Iraq actually has the legitimate legitimacy
so
to
Iraqis
claim.
So Iraqis have the power play here.
Yeah, but not anymore, because now Iraq became the so-called sub control, under the control of the Iranian regime after the shoot of Saddam Hussein. So Iraq, what's happening in Iraq, in the government is of Iraq, anywhere, it's really under dictatorship of Iran. So Iraq became actually a yard for the Iranian regime, thanks to Americans, you know, coming back to this kind of jungle law. I mean, the Iranian regime couldn't thank enough U.S. for their military operation to remove Saddam for that.
Okay, yeah. So Iran has like its own iron curtain behind which Iraq is currently.
Yes.
And let alone, well, there are other areas like Kurdish.
Also money laundering, you know, turning all the boycotts. It happens via Iraqi banks. You know, it's very visible, but at the same time, I'm surprised that no one can even talk about it or, you know, show it. Yes, how Iran can survive because of that. And also not forgetting this huge industry of cryptocurrency. The cryptocurrency in Iran saved mullahs' ass for many, many years. You know, they are mining bitcoins. Can you?
And wow! Yes. Where
they
do
are
they
inside
do that?
Iran. You know, they are. They have been one of the main miners of the Bitcoin since Bitcoin actually got hit in the whole world. So, all this money laundering, all this kind of exchange of the oil, petroleum, you know, and you name it, the arm dealing, everything goes through the cryptocurrency, because Iran actually can claim a very big part in the whole industry of the cryptocurrency. And it's not only Iran. Russia is doing it. China is doing it. North Korea is doing it because they have electricity. And they, of course, you can set up a server. It's very easy to do that.
Yeah, so, they are doing it in Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan.
Yes.
Somewhere where they're even using coal to power the electricity.
Yes.
That's totally...
Yes.
Awful. That's a crime to the environment.
Yes.
But hey, I have to ask you more about this. Iraqi banks, you said, they do a lot of money laundering. So what is their major business? I know Iran is selling weapons to Russia. Now it seems that this situation is going really, really badly, because I heard also, I just read today, I read Politico. You can say whether I got right information or not, but I just also checked out the International Studies of War and Politico and something else on the journalism field, those who are doing investigative journalism on war. We don't know yet, actually, what has been hit, how many missiles and what has been hit, but what we do sort of know is that Russia should have come and helped Iran, because they are under the behind the same alliance.
That's what they were expecting.
Yeah, but they didn't. They didn't come and help.
Putin said his condolences, and then he even mentioned that it's so against the international law.
Yeah! Wow! Oh, that's amazing.
Made me laugh a lot to hear that from Putin.
I still have to ask you, Kianush, about your background, because this is so interesting and so important what you are telling. I hope we have a chance to have another discussion on this soon when we actually know more about the situation. But I have known you for quite some time. I think we met almost in the middle of the COVID years, or just before the COVID. COVID is COVID-19, so maybe we met at 2000. 19 or 18, maybe it was a bit before. Anyway, you have been doing a lot of drawings on these theocratic supreme leaders, and your pictures are really, they have a many standpoints. You are drawing missiles, and you are also drawing women. You are drawing women with their hair down. They are throwing the niqab and throwing all kinds of veils away and going to freedom. But also you are a columnist. You write to French magazines. So anyway, now that you have been following these things, do the people in Iran, do they know what is going on, and do they see your excellent drawings in Iran? Is it possible for them to see? I mean, you have been saying that they have Starlink. Maybe you have a way of communicating, or is your audience only in, or I mean, France is a huge country, but is it still there mainly?
No, for me it's very important to have my main audience, who are Iranian people, and that's why whenever I publish any work, I share it in the social media, mostly in Instagram, because Instagram happened to be a very important social media for Iranians. And Iranian youth especially, they are actively using the social media. Since 2009, since the Green Movement, it used to be Facebook, and then it shifted to Instagram. So since then, I'm actively using Instagram. And yes, I have a very good amount of audience, Iranian audience, via the social media. And then I've seen sometimes, I receive a lot of messages from them too. Sometimes I receive threats too. I mean, they're very kind of threatening messages, but this is also part of the game. You know, when you provoke, then you get feedback as well. I mean, I'm happy that I'm kind of, some of my drawings make them angry. Then I realize that probably my work has been good. Also, what I really like to do is to show and illustrate the wish of Iranian people. You know, since I've seen that they sacrificed their life for that, and I try to actually amplify their optimism and their wish. So I illustrated their wish, like, you know, removing the niqab, as you mentioned, and also humiliating Khamenei at the time that he was so proud of himself, he was untouchable. I was humiliating him in the worst possible way, because I knew that seeing this picture and sharing it among the Iranians, it gives them a fresh hope. And as if, you know, you have a blocked mouth and someone is actually speaking loud on your behalf. It's a good feeling. It's a feeling of relief. So I always saw myself as someone who, in my own way, amplifying the voice of Iranian inside Iran. But then, of course, there are French audience, there are European audience. I also take care of them as well, because I believe there are so many important issues that I have to deal with, because I have an experience of living under a very theocratic dictatorship. I sometimes, most of the time, I warn the democratic countries that be careful, don't take your democracy for granted.
Mm-hmm. That's a very, very important warning. Yeah. But Instagram is a good way how you distribute your drawings and your cartoons. But also when you are talking about these things like the money being laundered and the Iraqi banks and things like that, do the Iranians have access to the news and to free media? Because I know that the situation of freedom of speech, freedom of expression, and freedom of journalism, they are in terrible
condition. Yes,
they do. Now,
they risk their life to have access.
Yeah.
They, I mean, for example, putting the satellite dishes is illegal, but almost all Iranian families, they have one. Mm-hmm. So they don't care. They don't care about the rules. They just thirsty about getting the information. And that's a big, big win for us as journalists, activists in exile, because then we are sure that we can actually reach our voices to them inside the country.
And also, you have friends Iraqian friends, yes. Because we have the same friends.
Yes, yes.
I have Iraqian friends yeah. too, and it's wonderful to hear. Well, actually, not yeah. always wonderful to hear what's going on in Iraq because the news are so yeah. so sad.
Yes.
But anyway, you do get along with
of course,
each other. So
yes.
there's
not, yeah, we have a common enemy, and Iraqi people. I mean, also I met a lot of
what is the common enemy?
Iranian regime.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously. And their influence corrupting their country, you know,
mm-hmm.
exploiting
yes.
their natural resources. Also, this is terrible, what was happening. Actually, Iran is colonizing actively Iraq for a very long time, since the shoot of Saddam Hussein. And I met many Iraqi artists as well in Paris when I was still living there, and I kept my contact with a few of them. They also told me the consequences of this regime being present in Iraq. Somehow they created a shadow dictatorship inside mm-hmm. Iraq. This is crazy.
Who's actually running Iraq right now?
I mean, that's a good question. I don't think yeah. that anyone can answer it correctly.
I have tried yeah, to figure
you,
that out.
You have a so-called prime minister, you have so-called president, mm-hmm. but they don't mean anything, actually.
And the banks.
Yes, and the banks, yes.
Who's owning the banks?
Do they I have no clue, but I can tell you.
Do they have like Qatar money, Saudi money?
I think they have mostly the money of the Guardians of the Revolution, Islamic Revolution, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Yes.
Yeah, not
which,
from
which
Emirates.
Which are not nothing. No, no.
Yeah.
Which is billions, I mean.
Okay.
Yes.
Whoa.
Yes, yes. It's huge.
Whoa. That's huge.
Yeah.
Hey, we are definitely going to have another discussion later
yeah.
when this has established, and then we might do something that we have discussion out in the public in the center of Helsinki, possibly
wonderful.
With Professor Teivo Teivainen, but we
oh, yes,
can't
absolutely.
Say anything about the time now because
yeah.
Teivo Teivainen is now he's traveling elsewhere, so we'll figure that out later.
Okay.
Just a few words about the neighboring country still, because today it was in the Finnish news that Finland, like all the European countries, I think France and the UK have done some solutions, and Germany, but anyway, there are lots of tourists or people who work from European countries who work in the area, not in Iran, but in definitely in Doha and
Dubai.
And Dubai, yeah. Yeah. So anyway, the planes don't fly there anymore from Northern
of course,
Europe, at least. So,
of course.
So I heard that they will be evacuated through Thailand, which
yes.
is really far away.
Yes.
Anyway, but what is the situation between these countries? I remember that at the time when the Football World Cup championships, like we say in Finland,
Qatar,
but
in Qatar.
They were in
yeah.
Qatar, and then it was widely discussed that the Qatarians use a lot of slavery from India
yes.
and Pakistan
yes. yeah.
and everything, and that was done with big money
yeah.
and totally corrupt. FIFA and UEFA
yes.
wanted to have these kind
yeah.
of things there. So, what's the situation now? Are these billionaires in these countries, are they supporting any kind of revolution or people or
no,
whatever,
no,
or theocracy in Iran?
The only thing they support is their own money. Because I think the first reason why they are there is because they don't want to pay tax, you know. When it comes to Europeans who are based there, I mean.
Yeah,
now
yeah.
It became a very national joke in France because there are so many these influencers, you know, those youngsters who mm-hmm. became influencer, and then they try to harvest millions by actually scamming the others. So they preferred to escape France to be settled in Dubai, and they were actually showing off how amazing their life is, and they don't pay anything as tax and etc. And now they're begging from France to come and save them. So now in France, it became
babies.
A big topic that they're actually, I mean, it's also very mean, but in a French mean way, that, hey, okay, you were kind of showing us how smart you are, not paying your taxes, and now you want us to save. So we are not really living bad in France, are we? So I think it's a kind of a very sarcastic, funny situation in this chaos, showing how we people, we are totally disconnected from the whole world, I think.
I mean, those people who never understood
what is freedom, what is democracy. They took everything for granted, and then they just moved to Dubai, thinking that they could evade this very fundamental, actually, obligation they have to their own society, which is paying tax, by the way.
Yeah,
they couldn't understand that, and then now. Probably that will be a good lesson for them, because when they hear explosion, when they see what is actually the shape of a bomb or drone, then probably when next time when they come back to France, they actually do their duty.
Oh my goodness. And also, like, it's not just, I mean, a number of the workers who were possibly killed or casualties under these when they made the stadiums in Qatar,
yes.
that's many people. Maybe it's tens, maybe hundreds. We don't know, because yes. they are totally nameless, yes. faceless people. Yes. We don't know.
Absolutely.
But then we do know of some people who have name and face. One was this journalist who was killed in the Turkish embassy by Mohammed bin Salman, because he was the one who gave the order.
Washington Post journalist, yes.
Yes. And after that, also we know that there has been, because there was a Finnish lady who got involved in this, this princess wanted to escape the court.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I heard that.
And, and then she was brought back. So, these are very, these are individuals. The princess has vanished, maybe. Nobody knows where she is. And she's under curfew or prison, or she's forcefully married to somebody. But anyway, so that's what's happening in these countries, in these neighboring countries. And they are like some kind of oil business theocracies. What are they?
I think they managed to become smart since 20 years ago or 30 years ago. And they start actually, I'm going to be rude now, they started to corrupt the European bureaucracy, mm-hmm. including European Commission, including European Parliament, and the politicians, European politicians. And they actually bought influence in the whole Western countries. That's why they always feel, they're still feeling so protected and safe. They know that nothing will go after them by these abuses that you just mentioned. Sadly, because their money is in here, in the West. And as long as they are sure about that, the money can buy them security or safety, and silence, of course, what is going to push them to do otherwise? That's my critics as a person who comes from the region. Mm-hmm. And I see how money, unfortunately, destroys the fundamental values that generations, for decades and centuries, they just fought for it.
And just to make clear for people who listen to this, we are now talking about this Arab Emirates leaders and Qatar.
Yes, I am talking about
these.
Them.
Yes, exactly.
I am talking about the...
Definitely. No, but we are now... This is the different area from Iran.
We are not talking about Iran. We are talking about this, the small Arabic countries of the region, extremely rich countries. And luckily, some journalists have been doing their job doing the investigative journalism. They realized, for example, Qatar is actively supporting financially the harsh or extreme Islamism movement in the whole Europe. So they divide their functions according to their priorities. For example, Qatar is investing on extremist Islamism in the ground in Europe and in the West. And from the other side, Saudi Arabia is actually influencing United States because they have this ambition to become the leader of the whole Islamic world. I mean, no matter Shi'i, Sunni, whatever, because it's the Mecca. So we are the leader of the world of Islam. And it's a huge ambition, especially this guy, this criminal, this Mohammed bin Salman. He is the one who is extremely ambitious.
Yeah.
And he is showing off this modernizing the Saudi Arabia. He's inviting Beyonce or, Jennifer Lopez.
And Putin.
And Putin, yeah. Of course. Yeah. He doesn't care. I mean,
no.
There is no limit for him. And also he has money, so he can buy everything, almost everything. Unfortunately, that man, but I'm saying this, it's so unfortunate to see that actually his money works. Yep.
Yeah, that's sad to hear. But well, it's yep. It's true. Sorry, Kianush, now we have to finish this, our conversation, but let's agree on the fact that this is part one and we will continue maybe or online.
Soon,
I mean,
yes.
As a podcast audio like this, or maybe we do it at Rose, but next time who will see? But now at least we have been able to enlighten the tensions in the area. And what will the situation be next week? We don't know.
No one knows, actually. No one knows. I mean, except the Mossad, probably they know what they're going to do, and probably the army, United States Army. That's very sad to
Mossad
say.
Mossad being the Israeli and
yes,
secret
the
service.
Secret service, and they have been active in the ground for many years.
Yeah,
yeah. I'm sure that this operation that happened just recently, they have been programming it for at least 3 years, 4 years.
Ah,
yes.
I'm not specialist in this kind of area things, but I'm a specialist on excellent TV series Bureau de Légende French, and I know Mossad is really
active. Oh my God, yes, the French.
Okay,
yeah.
Okay, but hey, kiitos paljon, thank you so much, and we will continue.
Absolutely.
And this was Kianush, and I'm Ida of Voima magazine, Voimalehti. Kiitos paljon.